This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. The newest print edition of the Trumpet, our May-June issue, has a cover story called Climate, Gender, and the Fight Over Truth. It has a picture on the cover there of a bunch of thugs assaulting the word truth, taking swings with sledgehammers, firing with guns. You can find that article and that issue at thetrumpet.com. That is what is happening in society, and today's program has a bit of a theme connected with that. In our second segment, we're going to talk to Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about an event this week that represents a refreshing break from that trend, someone standing up and telling the truth. That is the announcement from the White House designating the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization. This is the first time a state institution has been given this classification. And it's a truth that has been known for years, but not stated outright. This has far-reaching implications for Iran and its allies, several of which have strong prophetic implications. We'll also hear a report from Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about unrest in North Africa, hitting several countries all at once: Libya, Algeria, Tunisia, Sudan, Mali. We'll see how these issues there in North Africa are forcing Europe to get more involved in this region, also in fulfillment of Bible prophecy. I'll conclude today's show by talking about how to be happy. First, we're going to talk about transgenderism and the pursuit of happiness. Transgenderism is increasing. Transgenders in the United States doubled between 2011 and 2016, from nearly 700,000 to nearly 1.4 million, according to the Williams Institute. That's an increase of 0.3% of the population to 0.6% in just 5 years. The William Institute also estimates there are 150,000 transgender teenagers in the United States. That's 0.7%, which means teens are twice as likely to be transgender as the general population. At the same time, transgender surgeries are increasing. In the U.S., they increased by 20% just from 2015 to 2016, the American Society of Plastic Surgeons said 3,200 sex reassignment surgeries were performed in 2016, and rates are also increasing worldwide. Now, the media and society celebrate this as a success. They say doctors can transform these individuals' bodies in ways that enable them to be who they really are. And that leads to greater happiness, greater fulfillment in their lives. Essentially, they say, if there's a conflict between biology and thinking regarding sex, the solution is not to correct the thinking, it is to change the biology. We can fix this through some combination of social transition, hormone blockers, hormone therapy, and surgery. And mainstream society has even come to insist that any effort to correct the thinking is some form of abuse. It's motivated by discrimination and bigotry. But there's another side of the story that is being ignored, and in many ways, it's being actively covered up. In fact, society's unreserved promotion of transgenderism, even to the point of advocating surgery, is ignoring some very troubling realities. There are reports showing that more and more transgender people who opt for surgery regret their decision, and some even undergo gender reversal surgery. The increasingly popular notion that medical treatment and surgery provides the path to happiness for people with gender dysphoria is actually sabotaging lives. Professor Miroslav Georgievich is a leading genital reconstructive surgeon. Now, for years, he has been voicing his concern about rising requests for gender reversal surgeries. He says people wishing to undergo the transformation should get better counsel. He says the effort to be politically correct is driving these decisions rather than what is actually correct, what's in the best interest of the individuals involved. And he says that institutions need to overcome their fears of political correctness and conduct more research into the questions that are raised by gender reassignment surgery. The British Telegraph published Georgievic's concerns in 2017, but this didn't slow the transgender movement's forward march. Now, while studies are rare, stories of many unhappy transgender people are out there. Ryan T. Anderson's book, When Harry Became Sally, has an entire chapter titled Detransitioners Tell Their Stories. And it is heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to read these individuals who they describe growing up dissatisfied or questioning their sexual orientation early in life. They didn't find happiness in sexual affairs or anything else they tried, and then they were offered a more radical solution, gender transition or gender transformation. Now, if you have a lot of faith in the wonders of modern medicine, it sounds great, it sounds easy. But the reality is, biological differences between men and women are far-reaching and very complex. Hormone blockers can prevent a boy's voice from getting deep, or it can prevent a girl's hips from getting wider. Hormone treatment can cause a woman to grow facial hair. Surgery can remove body parts that are specific to male or female, or it can attach artificial body parts to make things look somewhat normal. But the reality is, no matter how advanced or expensive the treatment or procedure, science cannot turn a man into a woman or a woman into a man. Our biological sex is embedded into our DNA from conception, and it affects every system in our bodies. So many of these individuals who undergo these procedures find themselves requiring substantially more medical attention after the fact, and rather than being happier, they often grow even more depressed, and in many cases, suicidal. And many of them say that the doctors who advised them led them astray. And many have, as I said, subsequently undergone even costlier gender reversal surgery. Professor Georgievic argues that those wanting an operation should be better informed. They should be thoroughly cautioned about the risks involved. But even those who don't undergo these operations are often sad and depressed. That's why they want the surgery in the first place. Advising them about the risks of an operation, it might stop them from the harm or the regret that would follow, but it's not going to solve their problem. You know, people who consider themselves transgender tend to experience far higher rates of mental health issues than the general population. Psychology Today wrote this in 2016, while approximately 6.7% of the general United States population suffers from depression and 18% grapple with some iteration of an anxiety disorder, nearly half of all individuals who identify as transgender experience these issues. What's more, over 41% of trans men and women are estimated to have attempted suicide, a rate that's nearly 9 times as high as the rate of cisgender Americans. That's the term that they use for non-transgender, just people who identify with their biological sex. 9 times higher suicide attempt rate among transgender people. Now, the mental health issues in the general population are already high, but there's something truly alarming about the fact that nearly every other transgender person experiences these kinds of problems and even attempts suicide. And the fact is that people who have undergone transition surgery are 19 times likelier than the average person to die by suicide. To die by suicide. This, in and of itself, shows something is dangerously wrong here. Now, the transgender movement will tell you that what is dangerously wrong is the fact that society is so hostile to transgenderism. This Psychology Today article asks, why do transgender people experience more mental health issues? And they answer, it has nearly everything to do with the way they are treated. So what that means is that the only solution is to transform society. We have to make society wholeheartedly embrace transgender people and any and all forms of gender dysphoria so that everyone, no matter how they view themselves or what they want to look like or which bathroom or locker room they want to visit or which sport they want to play, everyone else has to consider perfectly healthy and normal. And if everyone in society simply accepts everyone and everything and loves everyone and everything, then all those mental health problems and depression and suicidal tendencies experienced by the transgender individuals will vanish. Because to say that that individual might need to adjust his or her thinking, well, that would be bigoted. That would be discriminatory. That would be unloving. That's the thinking. So virtually overnight, the elites in American society and elsewhere in Britain and other countries, the politicians, the media, the educators, they have determined that this is how we're going to solve this problem. This is the message we're going to send to individuals who are dissatisfied with their biological sex. If you are unhappy because your body doesn't match your thinking, we have to change your body. And if you change your body and you're still unhappy, we have to change society. You are unhappy because society refuses to accept you and to love you for who you are. The thinking is that the only way these people can find happiness is if society embraces this movement and grants it every conceivable request. It is impossible to overstate the radical implications of the set of assumptions underlying this train of thought. It encourages many thousands more people to pursue the life of transgenderism. It encourages thousands to pursue medical transitioning treatments. But beyond that, it forces society to completely remake itself in order to prioritize what is supposed to be the path to happiness for these individuals. We must establish transgender restrooms. We must require medical insurance to cover transitioning treatments. We must allow biologically born men to play sports against women. We must replace some of our public school curriculum with gender fluidity instruction so that the next generation is free of bias and discrimination. We must strip authority from parents who would resist encouraging gender fluidity in their children. We must make it criminal to misgender someone. We must prioritize these individuals' happiness over privacy, over public safety, over parental authority, over religious liberty. Their happiness has to be the priority over all of that. And anyone who disagrees, well, we have to publicly shame them. And if possible, legally punish them. And then we will have a truly fair and equitable and accepting and loving and happy world. So the thinking goes. So in our elementary schools, children are encouraged to question their biological sex. And when any child decides to identify as a transgender, all others are admonished to support that child for it. So what happens then when the transgender child has trouble with other kids, or he's unhappy, or feels isolated or lonely? Well, more and more the blame is put on the other kids and on society. It couldn't be that child's fault. Let's just counter this with a little bit of common sense. Encouraging gender dysphoria in a child does not make that child happy. Studies show that 80 to 95% of children who have those feelings outgrow them, and they come to accept their biological sex if they're just allowed to develop normally. 80 to 95%. Convincing a child that their feeling of confusion is correct, there is something wrong, it should be changed, that's not going to make that child happy. And convincing him further that any trouble he has with other kids, which, you know, it's worth mentioning, every kid has trouble with other kids, but convincing the child that the reason he's having trouble is because those other kids are bigots, that's not going to make that child happy. It's only going to feed that child's sense of grievance and victimhood and martyrdom. Installing transgender restrooms in every building in America, that's not going to lead transgender people from depression into happiness. Winning wrestling matches and powerlifting competitions against women, that's not likely to give transgenders a genuine sense of accomplishment. Preventing any and all critical discussion about this movement, that's not going to give transgenders the reassurance they need in their lives. The fact is, no matter how accepted this movement becomes, it will not lead to happiness. The idea that sex changes and societal transformation will solve the depression and the misery and the heartache of this group of people is a dangerous lie. It's a lie being promoted at tremendous cost, increasing the unhappiness and trouble of so many of those who identify as transgender. And it's coming at the expense of privacy and public safety and parental authority and religious liberty. It's even destroying truth itself. I was talking to a friend recently who had a client in his business who was a transgender. The company told him, well, we have to use correct pronouns. We need to call her by her chosen name. Well, it turned out that this client was a man. He looked like a man. He dressed like a man. He sounded like a man. But everyone was going around referring to him as if he were a woman. And my friend said, I have never in my life been forced to deny reality like that. It was literally like the Emperor's New Clothes. The Emperor's New Clothes is that Hans Christian Andersen folktale about the emperor who's so obsessed with high fashion, and he commissions some weavers to make him the finest clothes that money can buy. Now, the weavers are con men, and they say they're making the most luxurious, beautiful clothes imaginable, but they're making it with fabric that's invisible to anyone who is either unfit for his position or hopelessly stupid. So for days, they pretend to weave, but there's no thread on their looms. None of the emperor's noblemen want to appear stupid or unfit for their position, so they all pretend to see the clothes. They fear they might be the only ones who can't see them. So their vanity compels them to pretend that they see them. And of course, the emperor does the same thing. And in the end, he's paraded out into the streets wearing nothing at all. And all the townsfolk are uncomfortably going along with the charade because no one wants to be exposed as being stupid. And finally, a little child blurts out, the emperor is not wearing any clothes. Dr. Paul McHugh was chair of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins Medical School. He was the psychiatrist in chief at Johns Hopkins Hospital in the late 1970s. And he put a stop to sex reassignment surgeries at that facility in 1979 because of his concerns over whether they did any good. He said that sex reassignment surgery was fundamentally cooperating with a mental illness, and he thought psychiatrists could help people better by trying to fix their minds and not their genitalia. Paul McHugh said, "The whole gender reassignment debate is today's emperor's new clothes." He said, "Onlookers to the contemporary transgender parade know that a disfavored opinion is worse than bad taste, so they just shut their mouths rather than stating clear facts." And he says, "I am ever trying to be the boy among the bystanders who points to what's real. I do so not only because truth matters, but also because overlooked amid the hoopla stand many victims." That is the truth. This is a movement with many, many victims. Parents who want to spare their children the miseries involved in trying to transition, being bullied into encouraging these problems. Teens who are getting swept up into this lifestyle that leads to terrible side effects. Transgenders who are being lied to about the cause of their unhappiness and about the solution that's only creating more trouble in their lives. And it's causing a lot of victims in society more broadly as well. You know, there are advocates of the transgender movement. They identify as transgender themselves, who know that what they're doing isn't going to make them happy. There was a transgender opinion writer for the New York Times that admitted last year that they're about to get genital surgery. They wrote, "This is what I want, but there's no guarantee it will make me happier. In fact, I don't expect it to. That shouldn't disqualify me from getting it." But the author believes being a transgender is the worst thing that ever happened to him, next to being born as a boy, and that nothing will change that. The author gives no solution. He puts all the blame on being born in the wrong body. How can the transgender movement gain true happiness? I'm going to answer that question in the last word on today's program. But in the meantime, go check out the cover story of our new Trumpet print edition, Climate, Gender, and the Fight Over Truth. This article explains just how dangerous this assault on truth is, how many victims it is claiming, and who the real author of this deception really is. The being that the Bible describes as the father of lies. If we want to pursue happiness, we have to eliminate the lies and the deception and embrace the truth.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The administration of Donald Trump has just made a very bold and unexpected move. It's designated the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization. This is the first time a state institution has been given this classification. It's a move with far-reaching implications for Iran, for its allies, and anyone who does business with the Islamic Republic. To talk about this, we have from Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hi.
So give us some details about this decision.
As you said, this is the first time that an actual nation has been designated a foreign terrorist organization. Normally, these organizations that have this title are like Hezbollah, Hamas, Al-Qaeda. They aren't backed up and supported by an official... Well, they're sometimes supported by official government, but not actually part of the government. Now, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, it's made up of about 125,000 members, so it's a large organization. It operates in tandem with the Iranian military itself. It's a group that's charged with the protection of the Islamic Revolution, basically to make sure Iran stays as an Islamic state and can fight off internal dissent and also project the Islamic revolution outside the nation as well. And it's in that part of it, the projection of the going outside its borders to try and push the Islamic revolution on other nations, that it is acting in as a terrorist organization in Iraq. Just last week, the United States came out and said that it was responsible for the deaths of 603 American servicemen between 2003 and 2011 in Iraq. It's been fighting inside, the IRGC has been fighting inside Syria for the past couple of years, launching missiles at Israel. It has been on the ground in Yemen as well, not just paying for a proxy, another terrorist organization to fight, but actually being there on the ground itself. And the United States has finally said, well, all of its proxies, all of the people that take the orders from the IRGC, like Hezbollah, like Hamas, like the Houthis, they are foreign terrorist organizations. We call them foreign terrorist organizations, but we don't call the mother a foreign terrorist organization. And so this is basically Mr. Trump coming along and saying that, well, enough with the charade. We know that you're all getting your weapons support funding from the IRGC. And so you are now a foreign terrorist organization as well.
So there's something refreshing about just hearing the statement of reality. This is a truth that has been known. It's been clear for a long time, but no other government was willing to come out and say it until now. Now talk about what the practical ramifications are. The fact that the IRGC has received this designation, what happens economically?
Right. So in terms of the IRGC, while it is a military force, it's also a very big economic powerhouse inside Iran and elsewhere across the Middle East. For the past, I would say, 20 years, and really speeding up in 2005, the IRGC became had its tentacles, I guess, in a lot of different Iranian consortiums, different Iranian foundations, different groups that bought up government projects, government building projects. And so right now it's estimated that around 15-25% of those companies listed on the Iranian stock exchange are actually run by the IRGC. If you look at the largest telecommunications company, largest construction company, some of the airports in Iran, they are run by the IRGC also. They're not run by a military faction, but the IRGC has its tentacles into the private sector, if you like, and that's how it gets its funding. And so anyone now that has a relationship with these Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps businesses are now going to be targeted with secondary sanctions by the United States. And so if you're doing a deal with the Iranian telecommunications company that is not part of the other sanctions that Iran is now being hurt by, the oil sanctions and such that they already have on them, if you're a foreign business now working with a telecommunications company in Iran that's connected to the IRGC, you are going to be the subject by United States sanctions, even if you're not Iranian. You could be a Belgian company that's deciding to do some type of business deal with Iran. But if that business deal has to do with a company by the IRGC, which many, many of them are, you are going to be facing sanctions. And so it's another way of pressuring the Iranian regime by taking away the finances for this terrorist entity.
Maybe you could just get in some of the details of how this affects Iran domestically and then how this would affect Iran internationally.
Well, internally, I guess, I mean, I kind of just talked about that briefly, just the fact that you would have even further pullout of Iranian companies by foreign investment. Basically, you're going to have a few countries that are willing to risk, or a few companies that are willing to risk financial sanctions on them to do business with Iran. And so you've got this situation where Iran's economy is basically just going to be generated, or the money that it has internally, And without any type of foreign investment into the country, it's going to be very difficult for it to survive. So that's rule. That's number one. Now, internationally, this is going to have a great effect as well, because there are the IRGC doesn't just work inside Iran. Its tentacles are also in other nations, Iraq especially. There's a lot of Iraqi politicians and Iraqi companies that do business with the IRGC. The IRGC has won a lot of bids inside Iraq and inside Syria to basically help build up their nations after the fight against the Islamic State. There's about $400 billion worth of money to go to somebody to restore Syria back to its former self after this civil war. And Iran and the IRGC specifically had won a lot of those contracts to do the construction projects, to build the national power grid, to restore the ports of Latakia and Tartus, to run the telecommunications company, a bunch of other agricultural bids that it won. And so now, if that happens, the other Syrian companies that are in cahoots with the IRGC inside Syria are going to be facing more United States sanctions. And so, in terms of Syria, if Bashar al-Assad ever wants to stabilize his country, he's going to have to make a decision. Do I go forward with the IRGC now? Before this happened, he could do that, and he wouldn't be targeted by further sanctions from the United States. But now that the IRGC is a terrorist organization, that could forever wed Assad to the terrorist state of Iran, and he wouldn't be able to gather any independence internationally. So that could have a big effect on him as well.
So this raises a lot of implications. Just thinking about the way that particularly those countries that have been closely allied with Iran are being put into this position where they're having to make some very strong decisions about their own future and the ramifications of these sanctions imposed by the United States, how that could impact them going forward. You mentioned Syria. I'd like to talk maybe about a couple of other countries as well, but looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, it seems like this decision by the United States, by the Trump administration, really could force the issue with some of these prophecies that we've been tracking for quite some time. You mentioned how this could divide Syria from Iran, and that's exactly what we have been expecting based on the prophecies of the Bible, describing these two entities in the Middle East that are somewhat at odds with one another, but that have very different courses in terms of their role in end time events.
So yeah, Bible prophecy is very clear that we are going to see this divorce between Iran and Syria. And it's really interesting. We've talked about for years how this could come about. We knew it was going to come about from the turmoil through the Syrian civil war. And now coming out the other side, it really does seem that Syria faces two choices. You have the world on one side, and the United States is making them make this choice. You have the world doing business that wants to do business with the United States, and therefore they won't do business inside Syria if it's wedded to Iran.
Right.
Or you have Iran, and Iran has more hegemonic ambitions than Syria does. Syria is very grateful for the $6 billion of money that Iran has poured in through the IRGC into preserving his rule. But now coming out the other side, you could definitely see that Russia, it wants to sideline Iran as well out of the future of Syria. It would like those reconstruction bids instead of Iran. So we could definitely see a split, and this is going to force that issue of the Syrian president going to have to make a decision.
Let's talk about Lebanon, where Hezbollah resides. What happens
there? You have this really interesting situation that, you know, if you are designating the IRGC as a foreign terrorist organization and saying to everybody else, you do business with them, you're out, or you're going to be facing sanction. Right now you have inside Lebanon Hezbollah, a surrogate of the IRGC inside the actual government. And so what we had was Mr. Pompeo 2 weeks ago inside Lebanon telling him that he was going to do exactly this. And he warned, designating the IRGC, and he said that you guys are on the short list, not Hezbollah. He didn't even discuss it with Hezbollah because they're just like the IRGC. He discussed it with the Christians that are actually in a coalition with Hezbollah now ruling. You have the president, which is a Christian. He's allied with Hezbollah, and you also have the Speaker of the House, who's a Shiite as well, but just a different one that's allied with Hezbollah. And he said to them, you're going to be sanctioned. You're the president of Lebanon, but you are going to be sanctioned because you are in a coalition with a foreign terrorist organization, and you need to pull the reins on Hezbollah right now, or that's what you face. And so that's pretty bold. We don't have too many presidents or prime ministers or anything like that that are sanctioned by the United States. That means they wouldn't be able to travel. They would have their visas would be denied to the United States. They could travel to other places as well. And so this is also putting Lebanon in a very difficult situation. They're in bed with Hezbollah, a lot of them. Some of them aren't. A lot of the Lebanese don't like Hezbollah. And the United States, unlike the rest of the world, has not given up on Lebanon at being able to come out from the Iranian umbrella. And this might really force them to make some hard choices there also.
Now, Lebanon is another nation that we've been expecting a split with Iran because of the way that those are spelled out in Bible prophecy. And you can look at those in the King of the South booklet that we have. That's available at thetrumpet.com, and also an article on the mysterious Psalm 83 alliance. Let's talk briefly about Iraq, because Iraq is another country that Iran has its tentacles into, but Bible prophecy says that's going to break the other direction.
Yeah, well, the way that I see it, and you know, I could be wrong with this, Bible prophecy is sure that Iraq is going to follow with Iran, but how that comes about, it might be because Iran right now is so heavily invested in Iraq and Iraq with Iran that they might be past the point of no return. You have, again, the Shiite militias that fought against the Islamic State. A lot of those were mobilized by the Quds Force of the IRGC. They answered not to Iranian leaders, Iraqi leaders. They answered to the IRGC. And so they're in parliament right now. They're in parliament right now, and they're calling for the United States to leave Iraq. And you even had the Prime Minister of Iraq the same day that these sanctions were put on, or the foreign designation of a terrorist organization was put on by the United States. Where's the Prime Minister of Iraq? He's in Iran. He's sitting down with the Ayatollah, and the Ayatollah is telling him, "You guys need to work to get out the United States out of your country." And so it really seems that Iraq, being so wedded to Iran right now, that they would, even though some Iraqis now are going to face secondary sanctions unless they pull out of this relationship with the IRGC, looks like they are going to follow suit with Iran.
So many fascinating ramifications. It's amazing how you mentioned Mike Pompeo making those statements to Lebanon a couple of weeks ago, and I guess that we had talked about that, but it slipped my memory as this announcement came out. But this does seem to be something that the Trump administration has been laying the groundwork for a while now. As much as the media want to characterize it as a sort of a fly-by-night idea that he just concocted, but the ramifications from a prophetic standpoint really are amazing, and we'll continue to monitor the situation to see how this plays out. We appreciate that, Brent. We've been talking to trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the United States designating the IRGC a terrorist organization. He's working on an article for thetrumpet.com on this subject. You can watch the front page for that over the next day or two here. Thanks so much, Brent.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Several nations in northern Africa are experiencing dangerous unrest, the effects of which could spread far beyond that region, as we will now hear in this report from Richard Palmer.
North Africa is smoldering. A spark just about anywhere in an area of land larger than the United States could set off a huge explosion. And an explosion in just one part of this area, in just one country, risks detonating its neighbors. A stream of migrants from one conflict zone could destabilize the next country over. The collapse of a government in one place could give terrorists free rein to set up bases and carry on the fight elsewhere. Sitting on top of this explosive situation is Europe. The migrant crisis stemming from the Syrian civil war has already pushed the EU to breaking point. A breakdown in North Africa threatens an even worse outbreak. It even threatens Europe's vital fuel supplies and trade routes. An explosion in North Africa would reverberate around the world. So what is this situation in North Africa? We'll start with the civil war in Libya. Libya has been in chaos since 2011. But that chaos has been far less destructive than it could be. Last year, for example, around 1,500 were killed in fighting. That's tragic, but at the same time, it's dwarfed by some of the other civil wars in the region, such as the 20,000 killed in Syria in the same time, or at least 28,000 in Yemen. In recent months, that country has been in a stalemate. You have the Government of National Accord that's backed by the UN and the EU and the United States that controls the capital, but the Libyan National Army controls most of the rest of the country. That's under General Khalifa Haftar, and they're backed by Russia, and they're supported by probably Italy and France. Meanwhile, you also have terrorists, including the Islamic State, grabbing territory where they can, and generally exploiting the weaknesses there. Now, this status quo was shattered last Thursday when Haftar began marching on Tripoli. His march threatens to unleash a new scale of fighting in Libya. The US has withdrawn the small number of forces it has in Tripoli. Stratfor warned yesterday that the conflict in Libya has entered a new phase. They wrote that with their forward progress halted, it's unlikely that Haftar's forces will be able to take full control of the capital anytime soon, leading to a high probability that the battle will become a protracted affair. And this could push Libya's civil war to a new level of violence. Meanwhile, Stratfor also warned that with Haftar's forces stretched thin, rival militias and terrorist groups in the territory that the LNA already has seized, such as in Benghazi, will have the opportunity to regain a foothold. The chaos emerging from another full-scale conflict could allow the Islamic State to re-strengthen as potential crises continue in Algeria and Sudan. Which brings us to the crises in some of Libya's neighbors. In Algeria, the protests continue despite President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's resignation. As I talked about on Friday's Trumpet Hour, the demonstrators there don't just want a new figurehead, they want a new regime and a new system of government for the country. Instead of quieting down, the unrest is spreading to Tunisia. Thus far, Tunisia has been the Arab Spring's only real success story. Under their president, they've barely kept the Islamists out. But over the weekend, their president announced that he would not be standing for a second term. He's going to end his presidency in the autumn. His announcement came as movements were beginning on social media to call for his ouster, inspired by what's happening in Algeria. There are no other high-profile replacements really for him on the horizon. His party's asked him to stay in place. But he's on his way out. He's going. Now, Tunisia's number two party is an Islamic party inspired by the Iranian Revolution and the Muslim Brotherhood. In 2016, they declared themselves Muslim Democrats. But how they respond when they have the chance to gain power remains to be seen. There's plenty of potential for radical Islam in Tunisia. But to the southeast of Libya, there's another regime, really under siege. Sudan's president Omar al-Bashir, he's been fending off demonstrators since the end of last year. But now they're becoming more serious than ever. Reports on what's going on exactly on the ground conflict somewhat, but the general picture seems to be that on Saturday, activists marched on the compound that contains the defense minister and the presidential palace, and they were trying to get the army to turn against the president. Reuters wrote that on Monday, riot police and intelligence service personnel charged the demonstrators with pickup trucks while firing tear gas. But witnesses and activists say soldiers moved to protect the protesters. And the Times of London is reporting that the security forces have split, with some defending the protesters, others supporting the president. So the protests continue, and there's the very real prospect that they could topple al-Bashir. The UK, US and Norway have called on him to step down. And there's good reason. Al-Bashir is a pretty horrible individual. He's the only sitting state indicted by the International Criminal Court for genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. But at the same time, the consequences of a collapse in Sudan, for Europe especially, are very clear. A dramatic increase in refugee numbers, a huge terrorist base that can be used to spread radical Islam throughout both North and West Africa. And that's why the EU works with and even pays this wanted war criminal. Now, these are just the flare-ups from the last few days. You look at other longer-term problems. You've got Mali, for example, where nearly 90,000 have been forced to flee their homes since January, as you have a growing clash between tribal militia and various different armed groups in the north and center of the problem. And this is the most important point here. All of these areas have tensions and troubles that aren't going to go away quickly. These hotspots have all flared up this week, and maybe we'll have an imminent explosion. But even if we don't, there's still a long-term danger. This region is on the brink of an explosion. And it's an explosion that your Bible prophesied. And an explosion that your Bible prophesied how it would end. Daniel chapter 11, verse 40 to 45, contains prophecy for the time of the end. And so much of those events that it talks about revolve around North Africa. It describes a showdown between the King of the North and the King of the South. The King of the North is a German-led Europe. The King of the South is radical Islam led by Iran. And our free booklet, The King of the South, will help you prove this for yourself. But Daniel chapter 11 and verse 43 describes Libya, Ethiopia, and Egypt on the opposite side to the King of the North. They're aligned with Iran. That's a huge shift. Egypt is against Iran right now. Ethiopia is a Christian country right now. But the Bible says there's going to be a big shift, and the events on the ground clearly show that a major shift is building.
Thank you very much for that report, Richard. It is remarkable just how many countries in North Africa are undergoing this this kind of unrest, and this certainly has to be of grave concern to European leaders. Can you just talk a little bit more about how this is forcing Europe to intervene more directly in that region, and really how it could even use these troubles as a pretense to strengthen its encirclement of its biggest enemy in the region, Iran?
Well, Europe doesn't really have a choice at this point other than get more involved in the region. We've already seen what just one relatively small country destabilizing can do to Europe in terms of what's happened in Syria and all the migrants that have come into Europe and all the problems that's caused. For European leaders, they're looking at this, they're seeing that, you know, this isn't just one country, this is perhaps potentially an area of land bigger than the United States that could destabilize. So, yeah, they've got to get involved. It's literally their jobs on the line, because they're the politicians in place are the ones that would be getting voted out of office. And even things that people's entire political existence is devoted to, like the European Union, are at stake. So they're going to have to get more involved. And the Bible talks about exactly that. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 talks about this King of the North attacking like a whirlwind. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry explained that in this verse, the emphasis is on the strategy of this military attack. If you're in a whirlwind, it whirls around you, he wrote, it whirls you away. Look at the map. You can see the German strategy to surround Iran and its allies. The King of the North couldn't come like a whirlwind unless it surrounds Iran and its allies. This is being meticulously planned right now. Germany is busily preparing to execute a whirlwind strategy to rush upon and overflow Iran. And as he said there, you can see where Europe's been working on this strategy already, where you've got, for example, the EU and especially Germany contributing a lot to a military mission in Mali, where they're really working to train the Malian forces to build up bases there. You've got all the German arms sales, the way that they've been trying to prop up the Algerian military, for example, by building weapons factories in Algeria, selling them a lot of material. So you've got this happening already, but then you can really see now as the potential for instability builds, the need for the whirlwind strategy builds. And you're going to have to see, or Europe's going to be doing more to work with regimes that they want to uphold, doing more to train local armies, doing more to set up their own military missions. And you can really see how this is going to force this whirlwind strategy to pick up the pace even more.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is fascinating to see how this is playing into those prophecies that we've been talking about for so many years. We've been talking to trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the unrest spreading in northern Africa through many countries there. He wrote about this in his trumpet brief yesterday. The title of that was North Africa is a Time Bomb That Could Blow Up Europe. Go check that out. It's up at thetrumpet.com. And if you're not a subscriber to The Trumpet Brief, subscribe to that. There's always helpful information and very good analysis in that daily email. Thank you very much for your time, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
What is the cause of happiness? How can we be happy? There's a lot of unhappiness in the world, but the solutions people often pursue don't fix things because they don't understand the cause. Take, for example, the transgender community. Unhappiness, depression, even suicidal thoughts are many times higher among transgenders than in the general populace. And what is their solution? Gender transition, hormone blockers, surgery. And society says, well, all their problems will go away if we just remake society as a whole and we give them complete acceptance of whatever they want to do, even if it means installing an extra bathroom into every building or passing laws to punish people who don't use people's preferred pronouns. The more these ideas are pushed, the more problems are created. The more those transition procedures are promoted, the more evidence emerges that this simply doesn't help people like it promises to. In fact, many people later regret doing this. They say it was the most foolish decision of their lives. That's because none of these solutions gets to the real cause of the unhappiness. Many people neglect to even ask what the real cause is. But the underlying desire of every person, transgender or otherwise, is to pursue happiness. Virtually the whole world is united in this desire. But few people have ever found true happiness. Why is that? Well, the Bible reveals the cause of these problems, and it also tells us the solution. Proverbs 14 and verse 12 says, "There is a way which seems right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." The truth of this proverb is evident all around us. Solutions people pursue seem right to them, but it turns out perceptions can be deceiving. When we try to devise our own solutions, only then can we realize we're only seeing part of the picture, or we misdiagnosed the problem. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9 says, "The human heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked." Not only do we not see reality in many cases, but we deceive ourselves because of selfish motives or impure desires. We try to work things out to favor ourselves, but we do so at other people's expense, and that creates more problems. So what is the solution? The Bible reveals that it always comes back to trusting God. Proverbs 1 verse 7 says, "The fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." If we stop trying to devise our own solutions and we fear God and do as He says, then we're on the right track. That's the beginning of knowledge. Psalm 111 and verse 10 says, "The fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all they that do His commandments." God has actually spelled out the way that leads to success in life, And that way is his law, the Ten Commandments, the statutes and judgments. Put God first. Don't kill or hate. Avoid sexual sins. Don't steal. Don't lie. Don't covet. Honor your parents. Keep the Sabbath. It seems simple, but it actually yields the outcome that everybody wants. Proverbs 29 and verse 18 explains, "He that keeps the law, happy is he." Do you want to be happy? Is your life plagued by discouragement, doubt, depression, loneliness, even suicidal thoughts? Well, why not put God to the test? He promises that if you obey Him, it'll transform your life in the most beautiful way imaginable. If you keep the law, you will be happy. And there is no other path to happiness. Mankind has rebelled against God's law since the time of the Garden of Eden. And that's why we live in a world of increasing misery and depression. Some of the laws God gave us relate to family. They govern marriage, how a man should treat his wife and a wife her husband, what their roles are, their responsibilities toward their children, the children's responsibility toward them. And there's a profound reason why God established family and created those laws. Not only do they lead to happiness in our physical lives, they also point to an even more important spiritual reality. God created family to point to His wonderful spiritual family. And in His great mercy, God gives everyone, on condition of repentance, access into this spiritual family. You can read all about this truth in a booklet by the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, called The God Family Vision. You can find that on thetrumpet.com under our literature tab. But God gave those laws for a wonderful purpose. And because of our ignorance or flat-out rebellion, people have broken them with impunity, and generations have suffered for it. In the last few decades, mankind has attacked these laws regarding family on the largest scale ever, and the misery and unhappiness are mounting higher and higher as a result. Now, after 6,000 years of rebelling against God's law, mankind is still devising its own solutions to solve these problems, but none of them work, and suffering intensifies. And this lawless course will take us to the point where the world's suffering hits an unbearable peak. Sadly, only then will mankind be willing to be taught by God and to obey God and turn to Him. You individually can take a different course. You can turn your personal life around. If you turn to God and you fear Him and you obey Him, you can reject the path that society has taken. Learn about the laws that govern family. Obey those laws and reap the marvelous fruits from that. You can be happy. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal and Richard Palmer. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with this thought from Hosea Ballou. Real happiness is cheap enough, yet how dearly we pay for its counterfeit. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.